also like have these super fancy headphones. You think I figured out how to use them in time?
But your audio is fine. It's perfect.
Well, thank you. That's great. I would rather have like really good podcast level quality, but my husband actually got these and told me they would be great and solve my problems. And they probably would. I would sit and read the manual, right? But
we are not Joe Rogan level at the moment, so it's fine.
Okay. Is that your real background? It's gorgeous. Is that where you are? It's so nice. Yeah, because it's late there, right?
Yeah, it's 8 p.m. now here in Hamburg. Yeah.
Yeah, you picked that time. I mean, that's okay.
Yeah, but I'm really, really happy that you made it. I'm personally really happy because I'm a big fan of your work from the beginning, to be honest.
Oh, that's so nice.
We're really happy to have you. I'm really, really happy, to be honest.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I think it's fun to talk about medical training because it's something that you don't, you know, like these headphones, they came with a book. I just won't read it. But your medical training doesn't come with any book. I mean, this is a very hokey thing to say. Everyone, I think, just figures it out along the way and takes advice from various people. So I love getting advice. And, you know, in circumstances where I can give useful advice, I don't know, you know, that's great. I saw your paper in Blood Advances, which is very cool. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
We've thought of stem cell boost for our patients with bad cytopenias, but I've never really had to go through with it. But obviously there's a subset of patients where it makes sense. And so, you know, it was great. It's great to have that data set out there. So congratulations, very nice work.
Thank you very much. I think it, particularly for myeloma, it's quite attractive because most of them have stem cells in the refrigerator. And what we now usually do, we just give them prophylactically because we see that it works quite well and does no harm.
That's interesting.
And well, for myeloma, we didn't use it so far, but I think we will. We just go with it and see what happens.
Sure. No, that's a really interesting thought. I like that.
Let's start with your background. Maybe you introduce yourself, who you are, and what you do, what you currently do, and maybe a bit of your history.
Yeah, absolutely. So my name is Jennifer Bredow. I am an associate research physician, which is the U.S. government NIH way of sort of saying that your position is close to an associate professor who's kind of on a clinical investigator track. I work at the National Institutes of Health here in Bethesda, Maryland in the U.S., which is a suburb of Washington, D.C., through the National Cancer Institute, which is one of the institutes of the National Institutes of Health. And my mentor and supervisor is Dr. James Kochendurfer, who's very senior in the field of CAR T-cell therapy and really pioneered a lot of the field. And so I do clinical trials research with him. Right now, my position is actually exclusively phase 1 clinical trials of CAR T-cell therapy, new CAR T-cell constructs and products here at the NIH Clinical Center. And the NIH Clinical Center is, I think you've had folks from here on your podcast before, but it's a little bit unique in that we have a research hospital and really, with a few exceptions, but almost exclusively, we're taking care of patients who are participating in clinical research trials, not just in oncology, but in other specialties, hematology, rheumatology. So it's a really unique place and it's an exciting place to work. And so how did I get here? Not by plan. The US system, I think this may have some contrast with the system in Europe, but it's very, very long to include, you know, undergraduate school, and then medical school is actually a graduate program that you decide on after undergraduate school. And then you do residency, which it sounds like that's about the level that you are, and subspecialty training in oncology after that. And then sometimes there are even these, you know, BMT or cell therapy fellowships you can do for a year after that. So it's potentially a very long road. And I think that if you're someone who's interested in a lot of things or potentially indecisive, like I was in some ways, that actually has a few positives in that you can kind of decide what's your next step every step of the way. So I grew up in the state of Georgia in sort of a smallish town called Augusta, which happened to be the place where the medical college of Georgia was located. My parents were academic pediatricians. And you had Helen Heslop on, right? And yeah. I think she talked a little bit about this too. And I think a lot of kids of physicians kind of have this ambivalence about medicine, right? Because you see positives and negatives. So when I went to college, I actually really looked in, I sort of studied environmental science, ecology, and evolutionary biology. And so originally my thought was, well, maybe I'll get sort of a PhD in environmental science. Maybe I'll go to law school and go into environmental law. And I ended up sort of looping back and thinking, well, I should reconsider medicine. And I shadowed actually an interventional cardiologist, which was not something that I was particularly interested in at the time. And I think as a college kid, I sort of thought, oh, this guy is going to do procedures all day. And I don't know if that's my thing. But he was just so talented. And I think worked really hard in talking with the patients and the patients' families and really helped guide them through something that's really scary, right? Like if you have a myocardial event and then you need some kind of intervention or even just a cath, that's a really scary thing for the patient, for the family members. And I was just really drawn to being able as part of my career to talk to patients and family members about something that is potentially frightening or even life-threatening and, you know, help get them through that with the tools that we have. And as you can see, doing CAR T-cell therapy, I do a lot of that now. And so that was really what drew me into medicine. And then I went back home to Georgia, to Emory in Atlanta, and did medical school, which was a great experience. And they were really encouraging of folks who wanted to take an extra year to do research between their third and final year of medical school to do that. So I came here actually to the National Institutes of Health. I did a year of bench research, lab research in Dr. Neil Young's lab, who is a senior aplastic anemia investigator and really one of the world experts in aplastic anemia. And I loved it. I had a great time doing bench research. It was fascinating. Rodrigo Collado at the time was who's still doing research in this area in Brazil, at the time was a postdoc in the lab. And he really just guided me through everything and taught me all these lab techniques that I had no idea about before doing the year away. And I decided that I didn't really want to be the endpoint of a lab investigator, like Neil Young, that I really, really wanted to be a clinician primarily, but it would be so great. And, you know, a great maybe goal in the future to work with, you know, work very closely with someone who runs a lab, but really focus on clinical trials research. But I was just a med student. I didn't really know, you know, what was going to happen. I'll say as kind of a total detour that sort of just occurred to me that when I was a first year med student, there was a panel of doctors that kind of talked to all the students about what is in your future in medicine. And one of them, kind of a youngish guy, said, well, I think that first of all, half of what we know is going to be wrong, which I think they say a lot in medical school. That's kind of a stereotypical thing to say, and not wrong, but just developed upon more. And he said, I think a lot of you guys are going to specialize in things that don't exist now. And I just remember thinking, this guy is a little bit out there. This is very unlikely. But you know, you've seen this too, right? A lot in our field in transplant and cell therapy just didn't exist. At the time that this guy made the statement, CAR T-cell therapy really didn't exist beyond, you know, a few phase one trials of, you know, CAR constructs that didn't have co-stim domains and, you know, and things that were seen sort of preclinically in the lab. So anyway, sort of an interesting detour. So I came out of med school sort of thinking, I really like internal medicine. I like taking care of adults. I like infectious disease. I like oncology, hematology. Certainly the exposure to hematology with, you know, in Dr. Neil Young's group at NIH had influenced me. So I did internal medicine residency at Hopkins. They're a very big center in terms of hematologic malignancy, so you cannot help but get lots of exposure to that. I thought it was really fascinating. I thought that stem cell transplant was really interesting. At the time, you know, Johns Hopkins in part pioneered haploidentical stem cell transplants, and that was a very, you know, new thing. When I was a very sort of clueless and lost intern, Chris Kanakri, now really works in post-transplant cyclophosphamide and how does it work and can we make it better? He was my, you know, fellow who had the unfortunate job of supervising me. And so, you know, that whole area was just really interesting. At the same time, whenever I did outpatient care in the oncology center, you know, shadowing or helping the attending physicians, it was clear that immune checkpoint inhibitor therapy was going to be really big. At the time, ipilimumab was just barely approved for, you know, metastatic melanoma. And essentially there was nothing else, but there was a lot in clinical trials. And you could kind of tell that nivolumab and pembrolizumab were going to really change oncology. So I came out of residency with the idea that there were these two really interesting things. There were hematologic malignancies and there were immune therapies, and not really knowing much else and having a really kind of open mind. So I came back to NIH for fellowship in hematology and oncology. And it was clear here that cellular therapy was just really exciting and cutting edge. At the time when I started fellowship, there were no commercially approved CAR T cell agents. And really it was all anti-CD19 CAR T cells. So that was something that I kind of had in the back of my mind that was really interesting. And I just, you know, tried to work with people that I thought were doing interesting things. I was really lucky to work with Wyndham Wilson and Karen Dunleavy and Mark Reshefsky, and they were all, you know, amazing mentors. I learned so much about taking care of all the different subtypes of lymphoma from them. And then when I was rotating on the inpatient service for transplant and cell therapy, where they always need trainees to help out, you know, I sort of saw, you know, Dr. James Copender, Virgin Copender for my mentor's patients. At the time, he was the protocol for doing CAR T cell donor lymphocyte infusions was really new. And it was just amazing to me that these patients who had ALL, CLL, large cell, you know, take your pick, all B cell malignancies, that had every type of therapy, including allogeneic stem cell transplant and multiple standard DLIs, that you could give a CAR T cell donor lymphocyte infusion and they would go into remission. And I saw this is so creative and amazing, and was really this bench to bedside translational research, like I think that you don't often really see, and was really reminded me of what I had seen in Neil Young's lab and what sort of attracted me to working at NIH in the first place. So then I worked with him during fellowship and worked on the data analysis for that clinical trial that I mentioned. Just I guess towards the tail end of my research years at fellowship, he had developed anti-BCMA CARs and anti-BCMA CAR in the lab and had done the very first phase 1 clinical trial of anti-BCMA CARs. And we were just starting to see responses in those patients. And, you know, as you probably know, I was involved in writing up the data from those patients. And that was also, you know, just really amazing to see that these myeloma patients had everything. And, you know, the first few patients that we saw response in had really high burden disease and was just, you know, depleted down to nothing after anti-BCMA CAR T cell therapy. So after fellowship, I was really lucky. He hired me into the group. And then I've sort of been there ever since doing phase 1 trials of CAR T cell therapy. And it's been, you know, really quite a journey, but so much, as you can tell, so much of that is serendipity and figuring things out as you go along. And so, yeah, I just feel really lucky because it's been a really, you know, amazing experience here at the NCI to work with all these really creative people who are amazing clinicians and researchers, you know, all at the same time.
Yeah. You pointed out the specialty of NIH, and especially since COVID, I guess, NIH is just huge name. Everyone knows there is something called NIH. Yeah. You already highlighted some like really, really positive things. What would you say if you could summarize what the NIH is, what's so special about it? What would you say? What is it? What makes it so special?
No, that's a really great point. So, and I think it means a lot of things. So I guess I'll say, first of all, so NIH, National Institutes of Health. So this is a part of the US government Health and Human Services. And so institutes, there are many institutes. And so I'm in the National Cancer Institute. And then, for instance, Neil Young that I mentioned is at the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, or NHLBI. And there's a quote-unquote extramural program and an intramural program. So the extramural program is actually a funding mechanism for many university investigators across the U.S. and is a really, really important funding mechanism. I'll say that that is actually most of the National Cancer Institute is this sort of extramural entity. Here on the NIH campus, we're kind of a small piece of the pie, which is the Center for Cancer Research. So we're the part of the NCI that is actually on campus in Bethesda, Maryland, that is using this clinical center, which is again is a hospital used almost exclusively for clinical trial participants. And so it's, I think, a really great use of U.S. taxpayer dollars. I'm really grateful for U.S. taxpayers that this is possible. But essentially, the patients who come to us to participate in clinical trials, they are very often taking on a lot of risk and unknowns. That's especially true, of course, for phase one CAR T-cell studies. And so the U.S. government, through the clinical center, the NCI, essentially pays for all the medical care. We collect, as you know, in the U.S., we have third-party insurance. So we collect insurance information in case, in the rare event that patients need an outside procedure that we can't provide here at the clinical center, then we use the insurance so they could get that procedure at another hospital. But otherwise, we really don't use patient insurance. We essentially are able to fund all the medical care related to the clinical trial therapy, which I think is just a really fortunate scenario. And I think we're really able to learn a lot with clinical research because this facility exists. I just feel really lucky to be here.
Yeah, for me, I asked that because for me, NIH from the beginning is just, I always smile if I see work from you, because there's all, I don't know, maybe I'm too romantic about science, but there's always this feeling of like novelty and inspiration and kind of freedom you don't often see in science, because you have this all financial aspects, conflicts of interest, pharmaceutical companies, etc. And that was the same feeling I had when I first read your study in JCO, because there was this kind of, I cannot explain it, but it felt like there were people that had an idea and just went with it and made it happen.
No, absolutely. And that I feel like in this building, there are so many brilliant people like Jim Kochendorfer who are just so creative and really can do it all. They can run a lab, they're excellent clinicians, and they can take this little idea and just, you know, really have the grit to really get it through the system. I mean, it's really amazing to think that, so he and Steve Rosenberg, you know, essentially developed the AxiCell construct in the lab and tested it, you know, in multiple phase one situations. I mentioned testing it as, you know, a CAR T-cell donor lymphocyte infusion for patients with relapse after allotransplant. But then of course they tested it in the autologous situation with patients with various non-Hodgkin lymphomas. And, you know, eventually it became this commercially available product, you know, the second US FDA approved commercially available product. And it's just really a cool story. And I think you don't often really see that a story like that sort of happen from the beginning and then kind of see the end result and have and know that so many patients are benefiting. So yeah, and there's so many people like that in this building that are, you know, so humble and lovely that you don't even know you're running into in the hallway. And yeah, I just feel really lucky to be brushing shoulders with any of them, honestly.
And if you look back to your, let's say first or second trial, let's maybe stick to the myeloma trial. When you look back at it, what would you say, what were the biggest challenges you faced? And maybe even the biggest successes, surprises even?
Right, so I think about that trial now. So we're in a very different scenario, right? There are many, many anti-BCMA CAR T-cell constructs that are in testing. There are two commercially available products that are, you know, US FDA approved here in the US, ide-cel and cilta-cel. So you have to think back to when that wasn't the case. And so that study that you're thinking of, the 2018 publication, that study was, first of all, Jim Kochendorfer had to have the idea of BCMA as a target antigen, which I think back in the day, no one really thought about that. He first published the clinical results, you know, in 2013. And then the trial started in 2014, which was really shortly after I had come to NCI as a fellow. So that was, you know, really novel. The first patients that were treated, I think that was a product that was very sensitive to dose. So the first patients that were treated, really not a lot of activity at the kind of low, or even at this point, we would think sort of medium dose levels that with other CAR products and CAR constructs, you would think, oh, this is going to be active, really not that much activity. And then suddenly at a fairly high, you know, cell dose, a lot of activity, and a lot of toxicity. And so I think when we were treating these patients, we were really worried about that toxicity. And I think in that first trial, it was still the very early days of CAR T-cell therapy where we knew to give tocilizumab, we knew we could give steroids, but we didn't, is this going to hurt the patient? Is this going to hurt the T-cells? There was a lot that we weren't sure about, which I think now, retrospective, sure, but still very large retrospective series, we can really see that, giving tocilizumab and giving, you know, even probably fairly hefty doses of corticosteroids is, you know, not really going to affect your patient's response. But, you know, even back then, we didn't know that very well. And even with really aggressive toxicity management, we still worried about toxicity for some of these patients. So I think one of the barriers was really, how do we give this CAR T cell product safely? And I think what was learned fairly early on in the field is that burden of disease relates really strongly to toxicity and predisposition to toxicity. This is not how a lot of the myeloma CAR T cell trials are run now, but we really limited it to patients with less bone marrow burden so we could continue to study this CAR T cell product and learn more about it, but be able to treat patients safely. And people ask me about this and sort of say, well, is this the right way to do this trial? And you kind of have to think about, you know, it being the first anti-BCMA CAR T cell trial. In that setting, yes, I think it was the right thing to do because, you know, we were able to study the CAR T cell product more and still treat patients safely. And I think, you know, now there's a lot of interest in the myeloma CAR world of, can we, to the extent that patients are responsive, can we really bring them to CAR with as little disease as possible in terms of toxicity management and response? And so I think, you know, that trial was us learning a few of those lessons really early in the beginning. But, you know, patients and people who participate in clinical trials are really amazing. And I really, you know, everyone says this, but I thank them and I thank their families because they really stepped up and did this thing that was high risk in terms of toxicity and that we really had no guarantee was going to work. We couldn't point to these large multi-center trials and say, oh, the response rate is X and the durability is X. You know, we just had no idea. And it sounds a little scary, right? We're going to take your cells out. We're going to do something very mysterious with them in the lab and then we're going to put them back in your body changed. So yeah, there were definitely bumps in the road, but you know, again, you know, coming back to it, you know, Jim Kochenderfer is an amazing mentor. This is an amazing place where we just have, you know, we're working with amazing clinicians on the inpatient service. So there was so much support to get that trial done I think it's a really important proof of concept trial. You're absolutely right. There are for sure bumps in the road when you're doing phase one trials and you're kind of figuring out how do we deal with toxicity or how do we deal with this problem as it comes along. And even amending protocols as we need to, that's very kind of typical of what we're doing here.
And what amazed me the most in your study was this one patient with this malignant pleural effusion who had like, let's not complete response, but very good partial response, let's call it, which is you show the pictures in the publication. It's quite amazing. And you alluded to what you didn't know in that time when you started the treatment. What would you say today? Where are we now with CAR T? What do you think? What do we know, or what do we need to know urgently to make this maybe better, select patients better, and also this early enigma, which has been maybe solved with kind of experience, with nurse treatment, or nurses' education to treat early or intervene early or
yeah, absolutely.
Observe
yeah.
the patients. What would you say are the unknowns in efficacy and safety in CAR-T at the moment?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll start, I guess I'll start with, let me actually turn off my email. I'm so sorry, I meant to do this. All right. So I'll start with where we are with commercial agents. So we have so many FDA approvals. It turns out that every sort of year I end up, you know, doing this sort of local trainee lectures for the institution, for the surgical fellows, and then for the medical oncology fellows. And I'm just constantly updating what the US FDA has approved for CAR T-cell therapy. So we've got FDA approved products that are anti-BCMA for multiple myeloma now. We have 3 products for large cell lymphoma and variants. We've got 2 products for follicular lymphoma, mantle cell, not CLL yet, but it's coming, I'm sure. What am I missing here? ALL now, very recently, with Brexacel for adults, and then we've had Tisacel, that was the first one for pediatric patients. So we have a lot of options now. I'll start with toxicity management, because maybe that's the sort of easiest to take a bite out of. So I sort of talked about what things looked like, you know, on the ground clinically, maybe 6 years ago, maybe think back in 2016 to when we did, you know, our review in blood of CAR T-cell toxicities. And at that point, there were enough clinical trials that a fellow could reasonably, you know, go through them and highlight and look for the different toxicities and then kind of tabulate them up. So, you know, at that time, there was a lot we didn't know about toxicity management. I think that now that we have all these commercially available products, we have many, many astute clinicians who can manage CAR T-cell toxicity. We know what to do with supportive care. We know that these patients sometimes require ICU care, and we know when to call the ICU early. We know to give tocilizumab. And I think that, you know, we can argue all day about like when is the exact time to give tocilizumab, but we know from large retrospective series that, you know, it's 1 or 2, 3 doses is, you know, very safe to give in terms of response. We've got pretty good data in terms of durability, and that, you know, certainly sort of small to moderate doses of corticosteroids, same thing. We should give those as we need to for toxicity and feel really comfortable with that. The data for sort of larger cumulative doses of corticosteroids is a little bit contrary right now, of some groups saying, you know, that I think there's a large MD Anderson series that, you know, I've talked about before, that, you know, there's potentially a PFS OS signal. That's of course very complicated, because which patients get steroids, you know, right? And then some series, there's a presentation at ASH where they really didn't see that, even with large numbers of patients getting, you know, I think it was Axi-Cel, a fairly, you know, a product that's known to have toxicity. So that's a much better place. And so I think that we really know what we're doing a lot more of toxicity. Where do we need to go? I think that now there are some toxicities that were maybe underrepresented, or maybe we hadn't seen the antigen targets enough that really caused them, but we're seeing kind of delayed HLH, but it's being described in the literature. Nirali Shah, I think, has a really lovely description of this with her anti-CD22 CAR. That's a little bit poorly understood, although seems manageable with anakinra, for instance. We're seeing, you know, movement disorders with Cilta-cel, and it's on the label for Ide-cel. So I think with that as well, although I have to confess not knowing all the details of that, I think that's very poorly understood, that delayed sort of movement disorder, neurologic toxicity syndrome, although it seems to be manageable. Again, if you decrease burden of disease of the patient, if you intervene on CRS and ICANS fairly early. So I think those are kind of new things that we're figuring out. I also think now, you know, once you get beyond tocilizumab and steroids, we have anti-cytokine therapies that people are using. It's off label, I should say, in the US, more and more, but we don't know how to order them. We don't know in what scenario should we use anakinra, when should we use a JAK-STAT pathway agent, TNF, even interferon gamma, can we, use Gamifant off-label? There are sort of case reports and case series, but there's nothing large enough to really say, aha, this is our flow diagram of what we should do to manage steroid refractory toxicities or what cytokine therapy we should use to maybe even avoid the larger cumulative long doses of corticosteroids. That's a little bit of a kind of unknown for the acute toxicities. And I think long-term toxicities, and we talked a little bit about this kind of earlier, are a very big deal right now. So we're seeing, and this is really across products, but we're seeing prolonged cytopenias in a subset of patients. Our data that we published fairly recently and data from other centers really shows that patients that have higher grade CRS, that have higher burden disease, especially higher burden marrow disease, and not in our series, but in some series also more heavily pretreated patients, which totally makes sense, right? Because the marrow is affected at every step of therapy, that those patients are the ones that seem to be at higher risk for these prolonged cytopenias. But we don't entirely understand the mechanism. We don't entirely understand how to treat it. We've used some off-label TPO agonists, but I don't know if that's the right thing to do. Other groups have done that in other case series. We sometimes use corticosteroids and patients seem to respond to that. So that's a long-term toxicity that we don't totally have a handle of. And I think another toxicity is B-cell aplasia, which is, previously this was a little bit kind of a check in the box. You would give the patient IVIG, you would sort of monitor their counts, their CD4 count, their peripheral B-cell count over time. But beyond IVIG or subcutaneous immunoglobulin replacement, there wasn't much you can do about it. And then COVID happened. And our patients are very, very vulnerable, our post-CAR patients to COVID. We know they don't respond as well to vaccines. We know they can have more severe illness. And we know that they can actually carry the virus longer. Veronique Neusenblatt, who's an infectious disease doctor here, actually recently published one of our patients who has really indefinite B-cell aplasia after our HU19 CAR construct. And she just really had a hard time clearing her virus, and the virus actually mutated in vivo over time. That's a very serious thing for our patients, and we really need to make sure that they're vaccinated, they could get Evusheld, the monoclonal prophylactic, therapy if possible. And then I really think there's a role for convalescent plasma in patients who are ill with COVID-19. So those long-term effects, I think, are a lot of the game now. And while there are still things that we don't understand about acute toxicity, there are larger publications are really showing much fewer deaths because these multicenter trials have algorithms in place so that we're intervening for toxicity early. And small prospective series are just showing that we can give steroids and anakinra and tocilizumab earlier and earlier and earlier, potentially even prophylactically to prevent toxicity. So that's all kind of going in the right direction. But I think these atypical, somewhat delayed side effects and these really long-term toxicities are kind of where the game is right now. I think that, in terms of the sort of 30,000 foot view of the field, I think CAR construct is going to change a lot in the next 5 to 10 years, right? So all of our commercial products are fairly similar in that they have, a single chain FV, which is antibody derived, right? And the costim domain, and which is either 4-1BB or CD28. And I think that's going to change a lot. We already have experience with a very different antigen recognition moiety, our most recent anti-BCMA construct, which the most recent results were presented at ASH by Leica Michelinenni with our group. It has a heavy chain only domain. So that's so there's not a linker, there's not, a light chain. It's very structurally different from what we've sort of done before. And we're seeing more and more of that in the CAR T cell field. And I'm sure, you sort of mentioned our HU19 product that was sort of meant to be, well, can we improve on the overall axi-cel construct that the NCI has a lot of experience with? And so that has a fully human single chain FV, and then has a CD28 costim domain, but also has a CD8 hinge and transmembrane region. All of those, and a lentiviral vector, and all of those changes together. That was a very active CAR product, very similar to what we've seen in non-Hodgkin lymphoma with the axi-cel construct, but was really not very toxic. Like neurotoxicity was very low. Only one patient out of 20 had severe neurotoxicity. So that was really proof of concept that with some tinkering to the CAR construct, you can get something really different. And so I think we're going to see all kinds of different variations. I mean, we're already seeing it, right? ASH and ASCO, all these abstracts, which this is not the prior single chain FE that you're used to seeing. And I think that's, you know, I think that's the way to go and is really exciting. I think, you know, targeting multiple antigens, we're going to have fairly soon a new lymphoma trial that is a bicistronic construct targeting C19 and CD20, which Jim Kochender and his colleagues have worked really hard on sort of optimizing in the lab. I think with these bispecific studies, the idea, of course, is that you're going to prevent antigen escape. I think the data that we have out there now is a little bit variable in that sometimes we still see escape, and sometimes it seems like, oh, this really worked. And at least the very preliminary findings look like the response rate is really high, but then there's not, we don't have a durability signal yet. So I think the bispecific, I think that we just need to find the right constructs for the right diseases to have sort of multi-antigen targeted CARs. And that will be sort of the challenge in the next few years. But I think, you know, the dream is that, you know, multi-agent chemotherapy can put patients with large cell in remission. You don't just give them Cytoxan. And the idea is that, you know, with CAR T cells, maybe we can have target multiple antigens, not have antigen escape, and then put patients in remission, maybe cure diseases that are currently incurable with CAR T cells by targeting, you know, multiple antigens. I think we'll see the cell culture process change a lot. I think we don't know what is the most optimum cell culture process, but so much work is being done on this. Of course, in Jim Kochender's lab, a lot of work is being done on this. You know, what is the right cytokine mix? Should we have a drug like a PIK kinase inhibitor in there? There's, you know, a lot that we don't really know. And then really fast cell processing, I think that's also really exciting. We're seeing these sort of point of care CAR T cells. It's so exciting. It's really exciting. There's so many different directions that the field is going right now. And I think 5 to 10 years, we're going to have, I'm hoping, knock on wood, you know, more commercially available CAR T cell products that are, you know, helping more patients. It's the ideal.
But asking you personally, from a hypothesis standpoint, because when I, at least in my early stage, look at the literature, so the response rates, let's stick to myeloma, are quite the same across the board. I either use single agent, single target, or bispecifics.
By bispecific, you mean like CD19, BCMA?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. These tandem CARs or bicistronic. You told us about your new approach. What do you think from a structural standpoint is the way to go? Make the CAR, let's call it, simpler, or because then there's always the discussion with the tandems: are they too heavy? Can they have the right affinity to the target? What do you think is the way to go? Is it just trial and error at the moment and just an experiment?
No, I think it's a really great point. Yes, I think that tandem CARs definitely have activity, right? So that is one way to go. Another way to go is bicistronic, where there's a ribosomal skip domain, right? So then you have multiple CARs on the same cell, or even, but one vector, right? And then you can even have multiple vectors or multiple CAR products. So there is, and this has been reviewed in other papers where they have like lovely diagrams showing each of these sort of options. And I don't think we know what the right option is. As I said, that the one we're developing now is bicistronic. So I like that. I think it looks good. I think that, you know, there's very respectable data with the tandem CARs for sure. We do sometimes see antigen escape, especially, you know, these CD22 low populations, for instance. I don't know what's going to fix that. Noelle Frey presented her trial where really it was multiple CAR infusions, right? They had their human C19 product and then C22. And so Results were really very preliminary, but really exciting in her ALL patients, including patients that had had CAR T cells in the past. I actually had a patient that I really wanted to participate in that trial, but it didn't work out. But because of the patient, not because of Dr. Frey. And it's very impressive, but, you know, she also had sort of two peaks of toxicity. So if you put in two CAR products, that's, you know, potentially a negative. Although again, we're now a lot better at managing acute toxicity. So I don't know what the right answer is. I'm really excited about what we're doing and what we're seeing kind of in the future, but I think we're going to find out that we can do a pretty good job at preventing a lot of the antigen escape. I think that's going to end up being sort of low hanging fruit, although it doesn't seem that way right now. But yeah, I don't have the exact answer for you right now, unfortunately. Tandem CARs can be very active. So I definitely don't want to say bad things about tandem CARs.
And what do you think is the main driver for relapse? Because that's also quite a complex field. Either it's really just the escape, antigen escape, or is it driven from the microenvironment?
We see a lot of antigen. I mean, not 100%, but we do see antigen escape for sure. And I think that was early on really recognized in leukemia. But now we know it happens in lymphoma, and that because the marrow is so accessible, right? So we could see that right away. But in lymphoma, it happens. We know from biopsies. For our Q19 trial, we knew really early on back in 2016 that some of our patients, that the mechanism of escape was C19 negative disease in the lymph nodes. We know that in myeloma too. We, even in our first trial, there's one patient I'm thinking of specifically that he had a mix, but he had some BCMA dim for sure, if not totally negative cells at his relapse. So I think that's a huge mechanism. I think you're right, the microenvironment, and you know, many, many people say this, but I think this is especially the barrier in solid tumors. I think to some extent, this is the barrier in Hodgkin lymphoma, that just the microenvironment is very, very immune suppressive. So you can't even from the get-go get a response. Now, in solid tumors, I think something that's new for me, but pretty new in the field, is that we are starting to see some mechanisms of getting around that. I'm thinking about the report of the PSMA targeted CAR for prostate cancer that was in Nature Medicine fairly recently, and that James Gulley and Jay Redman here from NCI wrote this really nice editorial for. So that has, you know, basically it has a mechanism of inhibiting TGF-beta, which itself is kind of a inhibitory cytokine. And so they saw toxicity and they saw responses and they saw expansion of the CAR T cell product, which even just a few years ago, you weren't really seeing in solid tumor trials. And now suddenly we're seeing it with, you know, multiple CAR constructs, and we're seeing more of these kind of armored CARs, you know, IL-15 armored CARs and these sorts of things. And I think that will be eventually what gets us through to treat, you know, solid tumors. But yeah, I do think the microenvironment is probably a part of it, especially in solid tumors. And then I think in heme malignancies, it's maybe that the construct needs to be optimized. And we see this across heme malignancies too. It's maybe that the initial starting cell product does not have enough naive cells. And so again, we're working on here ways to really optimize the cell culture process, and many, many other investigators are working on ways to do that. So I think that that's kind of a large part of it too, that we have to have the right construct, you have to have the right cell processing for the right disease, and that maybe the microenvironment is a little less important in some of these, the hematologic malignancies, but I think is really a very important game in terms of the solid tumors. But we're, I think, gradually seeing solutions to all of these. I'm kind of a constant optimist, as you can see. So I think that, you know, there will be solutions to these problems. Many more, way more brilliant people than me figuring it out, but I do think it's gonna happen.
I'm happy that we agree on being optimistic. I'm also quite optimistic. And what I like about the field is just the constant creativity. and the production and the free thinking process on, okay, what can we do? How can we overcome this limitation? And how can we design? It's kind of an engineering process, which I really like, because it rescues you from this, what medicine sometimes can have, this like usual treatment sequence that you try every day and it works fine, but only because you don't have anything better. And this is, produces some kind of like frustration, or as a, for instance, as a young colleague, it's a great obstacle for open questioning. What could we do? What could we address? In that regard, I would like to ask you what, for young colleagues, because you talked about so many things in cellular therapies and CAR T, what do you have? Do you have any advice for them from your experiences, maybe from your, what you wish now, what would have been done for you, or what you could have done better, or what could have been better in general from the whole system? Or would you have done something differently in the past? Do you have any advice for young colleagues who are interested in CAR T?
Yeah, I mean, I think anyone who's interested in oncology, what I see sometimes with folks coming through the system or even kind of interviewing for a fellowship is that they have this really specific idea of, oh, I'm interested in this disease and this type of therapy. I think that can kind of put you down the wrong path sometimes. And it's much better to be really open-minded and have the focus be to really absorb and learn as much as you can, and really find the people who are doing cool things and just to hang out with them with no expectations, right? So people who are amazing clinicians, people that are amazing researchers, even if it's something that you don't initially feel interested in, just try to spend time with them, ask them questions, try to take care of their patients. Because if you do something clinical for someone who has clinical responsibilities, then you may free them up to give them more time to teach you. And not to put too much pressure on yourself to kind of make decisions. I think that's kind of what I ended up doing, maybe not intentionally, but that worked out really well for me. It's just finding those people that I really admired and try to spend time with them and learn from them. And you find that, you know, again, there's no guidebook to medical training. So you find that sometimes the opportunity that you really kind of need as a trainee is someone turns to you in an elevator and says, oh, I have this data. Do you want to write it up? You know, and that's it. Like, there's no multiple choice test. There's no like formal selection process. That person had whatever they were working on their mind, and they saw you in the elevator next to them and was like, oh, hardworking person, why don't you work on this with me? You know, that's kind of how it goes a lot of the time. And then you're just lucky if you're in the right place at the right time, essentially. I'll also say that something that I, in terms of doing things, wanting to do things differently, something I may have done in the beginning of fellowship was I just really noticed that a lot of the investigators here, and I'll say that folks, again, working on these fairly high risk phase one clinical trials, they really watched the medical trainees very carefully and made sure that everything was done perfectly for their patients. And my interpretation of that, after having finished, you know, residency, where the design is at the end of residency, you have a fair amount of autonomy with internal medicine patients, you know, and that you yourself were even supervising trainees that are a little bit earlier in the process than you are. So, you know, I was really kind of surprised when, oh, I think I'm being micromanaged by these brilliant people that I admire. They really must not trust me. But then, you know, I came to sort of find that, no, they're just really worried about their patients, because their patients are getting, you know, they have life-threatening cancer and are getting these really experimental immunotherapies often. And they don't know what the right thing to do is either. And they just want to make sure that we're all on the same page doing something for these patients. And so I think I really didn't realize that until, you know, several months in, oh, it has nothing to do with me. And so I think, you know, I think that obviously that here at the NCI, at the clinical center, that's a very particular sort of scenario, but I think it does translate to other training situations that, you know, if someone seems to be micromanaging you, or, you know, even if someone, Mark Reshefsky, I think, like, sat me down in a clinic and said, oh, you said this thing in your presentation that turned out to be wrong. Let me, like, explain to you in gory detail why it was wrong. And I thought, oh my gosh, this guy must think I'm incompetent. But really, he, you know, saw potential and wanted to take the time to teach me. And so when I'm talking about that, that seems kind of obvious, but I think it's really not obvious when you're the trainee in the situation. So always try to think from the perspective of the other person, you know, is this really about me needing to do something better? And if it is, great, work on doing that better. We all have to work on doing things better. But if it's really about the particular patient scenario or about the mood of the person that is talking with you, you know, really try to take that consideration, because I've been really surprised people that I thought, you know, that I worked with clinically, and maybe I thought they didn't remember me, or they even didn't like me. Those are the people that you can call on later to get career advice from, and they're just so thrilled to talk with you. And now that I'm, you know, in the transition from early to mid-career, I'm more and more sort of getting those calls. And I just love to talk to people that I've met, you know, in the situation of them being medical trainees, and try to give them, you know, who knows how much my advice is worth, but, you know, any advice for their careers. So yeah, I think that's what I would do differently. Try to think in the attending's sort of shoes. And I'll also say something that I've found is that folks, you have, you know, your mentors and the people that are helping you with your particular research projects, both as a trainee and then, you know, after training, this sort of like an early career person. But then there are always other people who are kind of your mentors and advocates, and, you know, make sure to sort of keep track of them and let them know about your progress and how you're doing. And I think that I've been perpetually surprised how open and lovely very senior people are to talking with me and kind of helping me and giving me career advice. So I guess those, in no particular order, those are my thoughts on training.
But it makes the whole story quite lovely, and it makes me actually hungry for NIH, to be honest. When you tell all the stories, it's a really education, and the path of a trainee is sometimes a bit ambiguous and self insecurity and everything, but mutilation, but you get over it, I think. And as long as you, like, stay optimistic, as you said, and I think another thing that Europeans can learn from you, and I always noted this from the first time I went to the US, is this really natural optimism and belief in yourself. And Europeans, especially Germans, tend to play this whole thingy, well, I don't know, I'm not really confident, but in their heart they try to be, but that hinders them to really just go out and do stuff, right? And
that's really funny. Yeah, I mean, we all have a lot of insecurity, right? So it shouldn't get it. Like, everyone, I promise, everyone has at least some level of insecurity. And so, yeah, definitely do as much as you can. Try to take the really big bite out of the apple, even if you think that you're taking too big of a bite. I've been there before. I think you're exactly right, that you just acknowledge your insecurity and then try to keep going. And know that everyone's always learning, right? Like, again, this is the sort of very silly metaphor, but it's, you know, class, like undergraduate school and med school, is so organized, and then there's a test and there's an end, and this is the amount of material you're supposed to know. But then you get out there and there's no end to the material, and there's so much that's unknown to anyone. Even the really brilliant people don't know it. And so that's, I think if you're used to a lot of the structure that the educational process brings, positive and negative, then that's a little bit disconcerting, that, you know, oh, now no one knows the answer to this question. You know, I don't know it, but no one else knows it. You know, or like, I don't know it, but I need to learn, I need to read X, Y, or Z, or see this type of patient. And I think that's really exciting, positive on one hand, and challenging on the other.
We went full circle from the start to the end now. it was a beautiful standpoint you made at the beginning, and now finished with that. I think we can end with that. I cannot stress enough, and cannot really say how grateful I am and happy I am that you responded to our request. And I'm really, really happy to to have had this opportunity to talk to you. I said again, I'm a big fan.
Oh, thank you. No, this was really fun. I appreciate it. And then, you know, we're at the point in COVID where maybe we'll run into each other at meetings in person for real.
Hopefully.
Yeah. Hopefully so. All right. Well, take care. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Have a good day.
You too.
Hopefully see you soon. Bye-bye. Thank you so much.
Bye. Bye-bye.